So let's welcome up the first speaker. He is the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-commerce Law at the University of Ottawa. And it is thanks to his work and his analysis that I think ACTA has become such a hot button issue, that we know what is going on. Thanks to his website, the leaks have been publicized. Thanks to his website, the people working on the issues have found a place to meet and a common meeting ground. So please make welcome Michael Geist.
Well, thanks very much, Nat. And that's a really nice introduction, I actually think, that's giving me far more credit than is due. I think one of the reasons ACTA has become an emerging issue is that there's a lot of people working on it, including right here, and I'm grateful for everyone that does. And I want to extend my thanks to Internet New Zealand for hosting this and pulling this together. I sat for 6 years on the board of the Canadian Internet Registration Authority, CIRA, which governs the .ca domain. And frankly, this is exactly the kind of thing that I think country code top-level domains ought to be doing in terms of trying to engage the public. And it comes at a particularly timely time, as was noted in just a couple of days. The next round of negotiations are scheduled to begin. And I have to say, typically, if I would give a keynote on this issue, I would try to make it a bit more high level and talk about the opportunities for change and what all of this means for the internet and copyright and intellectual property more generally. But I have to say that much of the debate, at least the framing that comes from those that are involved in the process, has often been to suggest that there's a lot of myth-making that's taking place on the part of those who are concerned. I actually came here essentially directly from Brussels, where I participated in an event somewhat similar to this, hosted at the European Parliament. And I was on a panel together with Luc de Vigne, who's the lead negotiator for the European Commission. And he referenced several times the notion that this was, in a sense, much ado about nothing, that there was a lot of myth-making taking place on the part of those that are concerned about ACTA, and that we all should, I suppose, just move along. I think it's important to, especially as we try to craft a declaration or a statement on these issues, some principles, and engage on ACTA, to put the facts on the table. Because while I can't speak for every blog posting that's out there, I can only speak for my own. I think when we take a look at the facts and take a look at the information that is now readily available, that even just yesterday, the head of the USTR on this issue, Stan McCoy, acknowledged the leaks themselves are largely accurate. When asked about the issue of transparency, his response was, well, don't we already have that in a sense? You can just go online and find something that looks an awful lot like ACTA. So we now have an acknowledgement that the documents that are out there are factual. And I think it's important to, as a start for the day, to take a closer look at exactly what ACTA involves. And it's, I think, based on that we're going to have a more fruitful discussion. So I want to focus on three things very quickly on a couple of ACTA basics, spend most of my time, in a sense, trying to answer the question that I get asked probably most frequently when asked about this issue in the press, and frankly, even when my kids want to know why I'm away this weekend, why is this such a big deal, why the concern around ACTA, and try to answer that, and then just close a little bit about what can be done. But frankly, I'm hoping that's what we spend most of the day talking about in terms of talking about what might be done with respect to ACTA. So start off with the basics, and I suspect that you aren't spending your day on a Saturday here if you don't already have some sense of these basics. But in any event, ACTA feels new to a lot of people, but the initial discussions around ACTA actually date back all the way to 2004, when what seemed like just yet another conference on issues around intellectual property, in this case particularly on counterfeiting, ended up becoming the focal point for these kinds of discussions. So there's a Congress on Global Counterfeiting. It's one that has now been repeated year after year. But at that first Congress on Global Counterfeiting in 2004, the idea of a specific treaty around the issue of counterfeiting was raised. And it was that where the genesis began for discussions around what was later to become ACTA. I think not coincidentally, it was at that same point in time that the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, began work on the development agenda, work to discuss intellectual property not just from the perspective of enforcement and stronger rights, but work as well about meeting the needs of the developing world, about things like limitations and exceptions, about access to knowledge, about access to medicines. Both of these actually take place at roughly the same point in time. The idea begins to germinate by 2006. The United States begins to reach out to a number of countries quietly about the prospect of beginning these kinds of negotiations, not to take place at WIPO. In fact, expressly, the decision is made not to host this within the confines of a traditional multilateral institution like a WIPO or a WTO, but instead to do this separately, almost a, what I've described as a country club approach, where you invite just a small number of people and they have the ability to set the rules. Within a year later, we get a number of countries, including my own and yours, that announce plans simultaneously to begin these negotiations. That took place in October of 2007. And by 2008, there are some preparatory meetings, and then the negotiations begin. And there are four back in 2008, starting in Geneva, then Washington, Tokyo, and Paris. And so it's a fairly aggressive timeline. Indeed, in 2008, those involved in the negotiations argued that they hoped to conclude it in 2008. Which seems a little silly now looking at this 2 years later and seeing that they're not so close to even concluding it now. But bear in mind, it was the time of the Bush administration, and there were those within that administration that saw this as a potential parting gift, the opportunity to try to conclude this kind of agreement before a change in administration. But that was not to be. In 2009, last year, ACTA actually was delayed with the change in administration in the United States. There were some who thought that perhaps the Obama administration might take a different perspective on this issue. They clearly have not. And in June of last year, just a little less than a year ago, the United States announced that they were now going to continue with ACTA. We had two rounds of talks last year in Morocco and then in Seoul. And in this year, a year in which the negotiating parties have said they are committed to try to complete ACTA, they are on a very aggressive meeting schedule, having met in Mexico just about 6 weeks ago, I guess at the end of January, meeting again, as we all know, in just a couple of days here. According to some leaked documents, there is another meeting scheduled for Switzerland and Geneva in early June. Although that hasn't yet been confirmed, I suppose it will be on Friday when there is the traditional release of the statement that we probably could draft now, because they always say roughly the same thing. It will tell us where the next round is, and in all likelihood, that's where it'll be. And the expectation is that they will have at least two more rounds of negotiation, perhaps even three, after the Geneva round. So this is by far the most aggressive rounds of meetings that they have had for a year, and so it reflects the fact that there is a real attempt to try to conclude this in 2010. In fact, not only are there more meetings, but the meetings themselves are far longer. If we look back to some of the early meetings, the one in Washington, for example, the second meeting back in 2008, ran just a day and a half. The meetings this week here in Wellington will run all 5 days. It's the longest meeting that they have had, and in fact, all the major substantive issues have been put on the table, each allocated a day, and then they've given a couple of hours to the transparency issue, I suppose, for good measure. The rough outline of the text, and anyone with internet access can go and download the thing. It's pretty easy to find. So you have drafts on the table. Great, so you could take a look. This is the rough outline, and I'll go through some of the specific provisions in a moment when I talk about why there is reason for concern. In a sense, it really breaks down to two main aspects. There is the chapter that is the enforcement of IPR chapter. That's where the majority of the substance takes place. That's where most of the negotiations to date have taken place. And that chapter breaks down into four sections: civil enforcement, criminal enforcement, border measures, and internet enforcement. So it's those four sections within that larger chapter that form the bulk of the substantive provisions within ACTA, and that's where much of the debate takes place. The rest of it is largely around institutional issues, things, as you can see, like international cooperation, enforcement practices, institutional arrangements themselves, that chapter drafted actually by my own country, by Canada. And as I'll talk about in a minute, ACTA is not just an agreement that sort of once it is concluded, if it is concluded, kind of it stops that day. There is a real vision of creating an institution around ACTA, potentially even one that would rival some of the existing institutions that are out there, like the World Intellectual Property Organization. So that's the rough outline in terms of what the text looks like, but what's more important, of course, is the substance, and I certainly don't have time to delve into all of that right now. But instead, I want to pick out little pieces as part of an effort to, as I mentioned, try to address why I think there is real reason for concern. And as a caveat to that, I think it's important to recognize that, and I probably don't have to say this in this room, but generally I think it's important to make the case again and again and again that those that are concerned with ACTA ought not to be characterized or labeled as somehow pro-counterfeiting or anti-copyright. This is something that you hear a lot. In fact, I heard it in Brussels earlier this week. It's been stated there's a big intellectual property conference taking place in Fordham, just concluding actually right now. And some of those same comments are being made, that if you are concerned or seen as being opposed to ACTA, that necessarily means that you're in favor of counterfeiting or you're just anti-copyright. I think that's simply not the case. There are ample reasons, there are many, many reasons, why there are people who are concerned with ACTA, yet at the same time want to see robust copyright reforms, indeed ones that take into account all aspects of copyright, not just an enforcement agenda, but the other elements that come together with copyright reform, including appropriate limitations and exceptions, access, and the like. I also think it's important to state from the very outset that I don't think that the case has ever been made that there is a real need for ACTA. If anything, today there has been a desire to shift that onus onto those who are critical of ACTA, the claims being, why don't you want this? Why don't you think it's necessary? From my perspective, the obligation surely lies with those that are looking to consume significant public resources, even right now, in trying to craft this agreement, to demonstrate that there is a need. And that's not to suggest that there may not be some need to address some of these issues. I think just about everybody can agree that if we're dealing with clear cases of commercial counterfeiting, dealing with issues that raise health and safety-related concerns around pharmaceuticals, unsafe toys, the prototypical issues that are often raised in the context of counterfeiting, I think just about everybody will agree that if there are things that we can do to address those issues, then we ought to do them. And yet, much of the rhetoric around ACTA, once you delve into the specifics within the treaty, you find that it often has very little to do with some of those issues. In fact, if you take a look at some of the meetings, it's been interesting. The talk often begins around health and safety. We need this because counterfeiting endangers lives. And there may be instances where that is indeed the case. But I know that in my own country, when our government hosted one of its first public consultations, the meeting started with that. It was a meeting that was hosted by our Ministry of Foreign Affairs. There were representatives as well from Industry Canada and Canadian Heritage, the two departments responsible for copyright, representatives from public safety. But then when a number of access to medicines groups asked where the people from the Ministry of Health were, this was, after all, the number one rationale that they'd been provided, someone, I suppose, had forgotten to give them the notice about the meeting. They weren't even in the room. And apparently the same thing has happened in Europe, where there are consultations and meetings on ACTA. The discussion quickly starts off with, this is all about health and safety related issues, and yet nobody from a health perspective on the governmental side is even in the room. So I think we have to recognize that there is certainly a rhetorical value that is used to promote these sorts of issues, and in some ways we have to hold, I think, the legislators or the negotiators to that. To be talking, if this is about those issues, this treaty ought to be confined to some of those concerns and ought to deal directly with them. Now, I focus my concerns around three specific issues: transparency, the substantive concerns within the treaty itself, and then the broader long-term implications. First off, on transparency. There are those that say, there's nothing, move along, there's nothing to see here. ACTA is not unusual in any way. And I think it's important to state very clearly that's just simply not true. ACTA, from a transparency perspective, is not the norm. Now, I know that there are those who would like to say this is just another trade agreement, and trade agreements are typically concluded in secret. Parties need to be able to negotiate and have their position without it known in public. Yet the problem with that argument is that this is not a trade agreement. It's an intellectual property agreement. Look through a typical trade agreement, and you find all sorts of things related to tariffs and other issues that are typically found within a trade agreement. Look through your ACTA chapter. You won't find anything on those issues. What you will find is page after page of substantive intellectual property provisions. This is an IP treaty. And intellectual property treaties that have been negotiated in an international fora have invariably been far more transparent and open than that we find with ACTA. Whether negotiated at the WTO or more commonly at WIPO, at the World Intellectual Property Organization, those organizations do involve the public. They release drafts of the text. There is an opportunity for engagement and discussion and consultation in a way that you simply do not find within the ACTA process. Now, I have to admit, I find it rather amazing that I'm up here defending WIPO. It wasn't that long ago that many of us were highly critical about the lack of transparency and openness associated with WIPO. And while there are still concerns about the way WIPO functions, the reality is it has come some way and is certainly far more open and transparent and accessible in a way that you simply do not find with respect to ACTA. Now, this is particularly true given that this treaty is also not solely about enforcement. This is one of the arguments that's made. It's not going to change substantive IP. It's just about IP enforcement. As you'll see in a minute, that's simply not true. If we are talking about substantive IP provisions and doing so in a multilateral, institutional, internationalized manner, it must be transparent in the same fashion that you'd find with virtually any other IP agreement. Now, note that there has been an important shift with respect to transparency. When we started this issue, or when the countries involved with this issue started with it, certainly in the days when this was the idea was just germinating, unsurprisingly, it was kept in total secrecy. When it was announced in October of 2007, there was still virtual total secrecy. It was a well-coordinated initial response. By 2008, when the negotiations began, there were little bits and pieces, but still not a lot. That very first meeting, the actual location of it remained a secret for literally weeks after the word finally leaked out where it was held in Geneva. And there was no agenda being released, certainly no texts being released. There was very, very little that was made available. By 2009, last year, as people began to take this issue on and begin to argue for greater transparency associated with ACTA, there were some attempts to try to deal with the issue. Summaries were posted about the roughly sketched what was contained within ACTA that did a nice job of confirming what had already been leaked online. There was the summary at the end of each of these various meetings, but as I say, it's pretty pro forma, and if we wanted to, we could draft it in about 5 minutes this morning for the one that will be released on Friday. And then finally, there were attempts to start involving some people in something that I think perhaps caused as much harm as good in the United States, in particular, a group of insiders, 41 or 42, I don't recall the specific number, who were able to sign a non-disclosure agreement and given access to just the internet enforcement chapter for a brief moment. But the broad public certainly not being made available to the broader public other than by way of leaks online. In the last number of months, though, as I'm sure everybody here knows, we've seen a strong shift and I think a good deal of momentum towards transparency, so much so that I think there are many who hope that this meeting next week will be a turning point, at least on the issue of transparency. One of the problems that we faced for the longest time was that we had a lot of countries say that they personally were in favor of greater transparency in releasing the text, but there needed to be full consensus and not everybody was in favor. When you asked, well, who is it that's against, they say, well, we can't tell you that. And so it was a very convenient posture to take. I'm in favor of it, but there's somebody else who isn't, but they wouldn't say who wasn't. Perhaps just as important as the leak of the text itself that we saw a few weeks ago is a leak of a Dutch government document about a month ago that identified the specific countries that were the source of the problem. That sunshine, I think, has made for a significant change with respect to this issue. So we found out that within Europe, virtually all countries were in favor of releasing the text. There were just a handful of holdouts, and within about 10 days of being outed, all of them had now switched their position and come out in favor of releasing the text. The European Commission now arguing that we will come to Wellington to argue for release of the text. Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Japan, Switzerland have long stated, sometimes very publicly, sometimes less so, but have been of the position that they'd like to see the text released, leaving by and large just three countries, Singapore, South Korea, and the United States. I think in the minds of many there is, one real barrier at this point in time, and it is the United States. Once the U.S. is the one that actually crafted the secrecy terms, the confidentiality terms, sometimes some people refer to it as the McCoy Agreement, that established the level of secrecy associated with ACTA, and it's the United States that eventually will be the one party that has to, I think, this week justify why it maintains the level of secrecy that it does, and ultimately, until it is willing to change, the governments themselves won't make this available. Now, as I mentioned just yesterday, or maybe just today, the USTR's McCoy said, well, transparency is now a non-issue anyway. ACTA has leaked, and you can find a text that looks a lot like what the text looks like readily available online. And yet we have to state, and I think it's important to state even within these principles, that leaks alone are not good enough. In what was one of the oddest exchanges on the floor of the House of Commons in Canada, one of our opposition MPs asked our Minister of Industry about ACTA back in December, asking the question, you know, when are we going to learn more about it? And the response during question period was that, from the minister, was that this opposition MP could check out Michael Geist's website. Now, I would, you know, while I'm flattered that the minister might take the time to take a look at the website, it is surely not good enough to take a look at a private citizen's website when a government is actively negotiating these sorts of text, and it is surely not good enough to tell people that they can rely upon leaked versions of a text as opposed to the actual text itself from the governments. Note, for just one reason why it is so crucial to get the text itself, the government officials will not answer questions about leaked texts. And so when Luc de Vigne, before the European Parliament at that hearing that I was at earlier this week, started off his remarks, he said, listen, I'm happy to talk about a lot of things, but I cannot and will not talk about specific provisions found in leaked texts. That would be tantamount to acknowledging that the leaked text is itself valid and accurate. Well, if the government officials won't answer concerns or won't answer questions about a leaked text, then that leaked text isn't good enough. We need the actual text, and we need government officials to be willing to stand up and answer questions about it. Now, that brings up a secondary issue, but I think critically important as well within the context of transparency. And that is, not only has there been a lack of transparency in terms of releasing the text, but so too, government officials in a number of countries have been misleading, I think, and not as forthright as they ought to be with respect to the contents of the treaty itself. And so, for example, much of the discussion over the last number of months has been around the issue of three strikes or graduated response. Now, what we had was a number of countries say, don't worry, there is no mandatory three strikes contained within ACTA, which, strictly speaking, is accurate. There is no mandatory three strikes. Yet, look, dig deeper into the leaked text, and you find that it is undoubtedly mentioned in a way that I'll come to in just a moment. And so the idea of responding to a question about three strikes and hanging your hat on this issue of whether or not it is mandatory or not, I think is in many ways simply designed to deceive. So too, this issue of whether or not there is a presence at all. Davini at a hearing a couple of weeks ago said that no one had even raised the issue of three strikes. In that instance, it appears he's resting on the distinction between references in the actual text and reference in a footnote to the text. It's all there in the leaked document that you have on your table. It appears to be all part of the same agreement, but somehow the distinction between whether or not it is directly part of the article or rather contained in a footnote to the article is enough to suggest that there is somehow a difference. That is not good enough when we're talking about democracies and relying upon government officials to be transparent in their dealings with the public when they face questions. So too the kinds of public documents that are released. We see continuously references to the fact that there is no substantive IP in this. This is just about IP enforcement. And yet, if you look at the text, you can't help but conclude that there are substantive IP provisions around things like anti-circumvention or rights management information or new provisions dealing with things like the labels associated with DVDs and CDs. These are substantive provisions. There are also claims that this is dealing solely with commercial counterfeiting, but it's not. Statutory damages have been used in the United States for now more than 50,000 lawsuits against individual file sharers, more than 20,000 in one go just a couple of weeks ago, with promises for tens of thousands more in the weeks ahead. In every single one of those cases, notwithstanding the fact that we are largely talking about non-commercial infringement, it is statutory damages provisions and the prospect of commercial-level damages running into the millions of dollars that is used in many ways to push for or demand very significant settlements. This is not non-commercial. It's quite clearly, when we're dealing with statutory damages, commercial. So too with the de minimis provision that I'll talk about in a minute. And so there is ongoing, real reason for concern around transparency. But let's recognize that eventually this transparency issue is going to go away. I mean, it is true that the text is available in leaked form. Maybe at the end of this week it'll be made available. Maybe at the end of Geneva. We don't know for sure, but eventually the text will be made available. And at that point in time, I would argue the real work begins. Because if we take a look at the substantive provisions, there are many reasons for concern. Now, the reasons for concern will vary depending on where you live. The countries that are involved in ACTA were brought together largely because there was this sense that they had the most amount of commonality. It was this coalition of the willing, as it were, and the idea was it would be relatively easy to strike an agreement given the sense that everybody had roughly the same perspective on these issues, roughly the same provisions. It turns out that that's not the case. We all, as countries like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, the United States, and others, may have the same goals in dealing with counterfeiting and wanting the issue addressed, but we take, in many instances, different roads to get there. And yet what ACTA seeks to do is create a commonality not just in the goal, but in the route to achieve that goal. And so depending on where you live, the implications will be different. In some countries, there are some provisions that will have a significant impact. In others, little impact because they reflect existing domestic law. To highlight a few of the areas where I think there are reasons for concern, one are on the anti-circumvention provisions. Actually, it's a reason for concern in New Zealand and Canada in particular. In the mid-1990s, as some of you will know, the World Intellectual Property Organization negotiated the WIPO Internet Treaties, WCT and WPPT, creating this legal, new kind of copyright provisions, the anti-circumvention provisions, providing legal protection for digital locks. Now, the U.S. went to that negotiation with a very specific vision of what it wanted the anti-circumvention provisions to look like, but they were unable to achieve consensus on their particular approach and thus adopted one that was far more broad and liberal. It was only on that basis that they could actually achieve a deal. They went back to the United States and implemented their specific vision, which became the infamous Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA. What ACTA seeks to do is take the DMCA and make it the de facto standard. In a sense, it seeks to renegotiate the treaty from the mid-1990s by narrowing the kind of flexibility that exists within the WIPO Internet treaties, the very flexibility that was necessary to achieve consensus in the first place. Now, there are a number of countries that have, whether willingly or sometimes less willingly, implemented that approach, but not all. The New Zealand approach does not mirror the DMCA approach, and if ACTA were to become law, there would be requirements to change your approach on these issues. In Canada, we've yet to implement anti-circumvention provisions, and this would, in a sense, trump the domestic copyright reform agenda that exists in our country right now and require us to adopt the ACTA standard, the ACTA standard being that DMCA standard. There are other areas, notice and takedown, in terms of what internet service providers have to follow. That's a standard in some places, but not all. In Canada, for a number of years, we've been using something known as notice and notice. In fact, a far more effective and, I think, more balanced approach to the issue, but yet ACTA specifies that it's notice and takedown that has to be adopted. There are anti-camcording provisions, something that is found in a few countries in the United States. In Canada, we got it after we had received a visit from California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, informing us that we needed an anti-camcording law, and literally about 3 weeks later, we had one passed. It was a record time in terms of getting that provision passed into Canadian law. Even the scope of the treaty is up for grabs right now. And so there are those that want it limited just to copyright and trademark. There are others, including particularly those from Europe, that would like to see this extended to all intellectual property, including patent-related issues as well. Now, the fact that that hasn't even been agreed to yet highlights the fact that we are still some ways away from agreement on this issue. But nevertheless, the very notion that we might have an agreement that deals with enforcement in such a broad manner, that deals with all IP, including patent, I think is a real cause for concern. There are the statutory damages provisions that I already highlighted a moment ago, the fact that it is both commercial and non-commercial, and then there are lots of countries, including within the ACTA negotiating partners, who do not currently have statutory damages in place. The criminal provisions raise all sorts of issues. Within Europe, it's actually not even the Commission that can negotiate the criminal provisions themselves. They don't have competence in that area. But the prospect of ratcheting up the kind of criminal liability is very real. It's directly within the text itself, talking about inciting, aiding, and abetting. certain offenses. And in fact, note that we are dealing both with commercial and non-commercial. ACTA talks about the prospect of criminal liability for non-commercial infringement in instances where it is seen as willful trademark or copyright infringement. What is willful for someone that has a large open shared folder on a P2P network that's got thousands of songs on that? Is that seen as willful if they make it available? We don't know, but it opens the door to the prospect of criminal liability even in those kinds of situations. Then there's this de minimis provision, which actually was an attempt to respond to the very first rumor that came up with respect to ACTA, the much talked about iPods, the border guards who would begin in, who would begin to move towards iPod searches. And so this idea of iPod searching border guards looking for infringing songs on your iPod became one of the big stories in terms of people covering ACTA. And while I think it's fair to say that the negotiators didn't have that in mind, and so what they decided to do was try to craft a de minimis provision that would say we'll exclude certain amounts of infringing material or a certain amount of infringing activity from the scope of this process, the attempt to respond to this concern. Now, at the moment, if you look at the leaked text, you find that there are three or four de minimis provision proposals on the table. And there are a couple of problems that we can quickly identify. The first is that a number of rights holders have already said they don't want to see any de minimis provision included at all. They say, what's the point of an anti-counterfeiting trade agreement if within the agreement you right away tell people, yes, we're against counterfeiting, but not if all you've got is a single fake Louis Vuitton handbag or a pirated DVD. If it's just that, well, then we're not going to deal with those kinds of issues. So they say we shouldn't have any kind of limitations at all, no de minimis provision whatsoever. Within the proposals themselves, though, they seek to distinguish between commercial and non-commercial. And yet, if we take a look at the approach that many customs agents and border guards have taken in countries, they treat your laptop as commercial. And so if the idea is to somehow exclude these kinds of border searches, this mere distinction between commercial and non-commercial may not be good enough, since the approach in many countries is to say that your laptop is itself potentially seen as commercial. Note as well that if you look through, no matter how many times you look through the draft ACTA text, the leak that's out there, you are not going to find references to the kind of flexibility that we see, the balancing attempts that we see in many IP agreements that are out there around the world. And so many of these kinds of provisions, whether we're talking about damages, injunctions, a range of different issues, contain within them a whole series of counterbalancing provisions, attempts to preserve a balance. These are not found in ACTA. ACTA is just a one-way approach, talking solely about the new kinds of enforcement, talking virtually not at all about the sorts of limitations and exceptions that are just as integral to having an effective and balanced IP system. In Canada, our own Supreme Court has talked about, in the context of copyright, creator rights and user rights, and talking about exceptions as user rights that need to be treated as part of that balance. That balance is simply not found within ACTA. Just a couple of more. Injunctive power is a new piece that was put out by KEI, Knowledge Ecology International, just this past week, goes through the injunctive powers and the damages powers that you find within ACTA, going far beyond what is typically found at least under US law as well as many other laws. Plus, there is, and I made reference to it a little bit off the top, this issue around institutional structures. So ACTA isn't a trade agreement that kind of gets created and then just stops there. It's, as I say, not really a trade agreement at all. It's an IP agreement. But it's not an agreement that kind of stops on the day that everybody agrees to it. In fact, there is a vision drafted by Canada of a broad institutional structure, an ACTA Oversight Council that would deal with issues around who can join up to ACTA who haven't been participants in this process, a secretariat, new observers who could come in as a way to bring in some of those new entrants, technical assistance. This is what WIPO does in terms of dealing with developing countries and their attempts to deal with issues around intellectual property. There are visions of specific technical assistance. Indeed, Morocco, one of the negotiating countries, wants specific dollar commitments from the various countries about how much they're willing to commit towards new IP enforcement technical assistance. There is even reference to dispute resolution, although that issue hasn't yet been fleshed out. So lots on institutional structure. And then finally, from a substantive perspective, it's important to clarify what ACTA actually says with respect to three strikes or graduated response, because there has been a lot of discussion around it. Here's what it says. So it comes up from a U.S. proposal. There are at least three proposals with respect to internet-related provisions. It's the U.S. proposal that raises the prospect of three strikes, and it does so within a framework of a safe harbor provision. So recognizing that ISPs and intermediaries need to have a safe harbor in order to be able to function effectively. And one of the conditions of qualifying for the safe harbor, as you can see here, requires to condition the application of that provision, that safe harbor provision, on adopting and reasonably implementing a policy to address unauthorized storage or transmission of materials protected by copyright. In other words, you have to have a policy in place dealing with infringement on your system in order to qualify for a safe harbor. And we should note that there are countries that do not have that as part of their national law. For example, Japan does not have any such requirement that ISPs have to have policies in place. But reference to the policy includes this footnote. And the footnote there says as follows: an example of such a policy, an example of what an ISP policy might be, is providing for the termination in appropriate circumstances of subscriptions and or accounts on a service provider, system, or network of repeat infringers. In other words, graduated response. So when there are those that say there is no mandatory three strikes or graduated response in ACTA right now, they're right. You can read that, and there is no mandatory provision. But what there is instead is a mandatory requirement for a policy, the only example of an appropriate policy being one that is three strikes, and recognize that ISPs will adopt a policy because they're going to undoubtedly want to qualify for a safe harbor. And when they turn to their legal counsel and say, what kind of policy meets the standard that I need to meet in order to qualify for the safe harbor, counsel will take a look and ACTA says, well, the only example that we can see is a termination process. And so that's, if you want to be on the safe side, that's the one that you need to adopt. It's not mandatory, but for all practical purposes, there are many ISPs who will treat it as such. That's where it stands today. It is very much on the table. Now, finally, in terms of why the concerns, I'm also concerned because of some of the long-term, broader implications that come as part of ACTA. This is explicitly, by the countries themselves, and a clear attempt to shift away from more open, transparent, multilateral approaches. Indeed, a number of countries have specifically noted that they look at gridlock, they argue, that has taken place both at the WTO and at WIPO, and said they've needed to take their activities and move them elsewhere. And so this is explicitly an attempt to avoid that more open, transparent, inclusive approach that we find within the UN system and do this instead within a closed group. And I think that bodes badly not just on this issue, but for the prospect of seeing this replicated in any number of other issues where suddenly the more open consensus-based UN system is seen as a pain, and so people decide to go elsewhere. There are constitutional issues. An op-ed recently in the Washington Post by Harvard Law professors Lawrence Lessig and Jack Goldsmith raised concerns in the U.S. context in terms of how they're trying to move forward on this issue through what's known as executive agreement, so that Congress wouldn't even review. And I think one of the core reasons why the European Parliament in the EU has taken an interest in this issue is also a constitutional one, because the new Lisbon Treaty gives the European Parliament rights around treaty making, and they feel they aren't being adequately consulted. And so real constitutional issues. And then for many other countries, it is striking. Almost everybody says that their laws aren't going to change as a result of ACTA. It's somebody else's that presumably will have to change. But of course, when we read the text, we see all these areas of conflict, and it becomes abundantly clear that everybody's laws are going to have to change. That's the very nature of negotiation. As I mentioned, this treaty doesn't deal with limitations and exceptions and other kinds of balancing issues on copyright. It raises very significant privacy implications. The European Union Data Protection Supervisor, Peter Huistinks from the Netherlands, has written a 20-page opinion that takes a look at the privacy implications both on the cross-border data enforcement issues and the privacy implications from that, as well as the privacy implications from three strikes. There are very real privacy worries that come out of this. As I mentioned, this undermines WIPO in terms of WIPO's ability to move on this. And in fact, it undermines not just WIPO, but the work that WIPO has been engaged in, including things like the development agenda. And so for those countries that have seen some gains in recent years on issues like a treaty for the blind or on a broader development agenda, those countries that need to have that consensus at WIPO may soon find that countries like the United States or the EU or others simply aren't willing to bargain anymore because their primary concerns around enforcement and they're achieving their goals within an ACTA framework, they don't need WIPO anymore. In fact, we've seen this exact kind of scenario play out before. As a number of years ago, it was UNESCO that was seen as the primary fora for many of these issues. The U.S. increasingly became disillusioned with the so-called gridlock at UNESCO and changed fora, went instead to WIPO. We are seeing that take place yet again, this time moving from WIPO now to this closed system of ACTA. I also think, just two last on those longer-term implications, Canada is one of the targets of the United States, seemingly on an annual basis as part of their special 301 report. We're in good company. About 70% of the world's population is included on the special 301 report as being seen as having substandard intellectual property laws. I don't think it will take long before those that haven't adopted ACTA or implemented ACTA are included on these kinds of reports. And the argument is you aren't meeting your obligations because you aren't meeting ACTA standards. And then finally, with respect to long-term implications, perhaps the ultimate irony with respect to what is labeled as an anti-counterfeiting trade agreement is that it is woefully ineffective in dealing with actual counterfeiting. This is an anti-counterfeiting deal without the counterfeiters. And so the countries that are generally seen as the largest sources of counterfeiting product, the Chinas and the Taiwans and the Russias and the Ukraines and the Indonesias and the Pakistans, they're not included in any of this. And so if you were serious about trying to deal with counterfeiting, surely you would include the very countries that are seen as the primary sources of these kinds of products. Instead, what we have are countries that say they don't even need to change their laws in order to be part of this. Well, what is exactly then does ACTA achieve if that's the case? If we were truly serious about trying to deal with the concerns around health and safety, I think this process would be opened up to include the very countries that are seen as a problem in this area. Now, finally, with this, I will conclude, what can be done? And I have to say that it is very easy to be pessimistic. In fact, in Europe, I have to say, in talking to many people working on this issue, there was wide waves of pessimism with respect to ACTA, the sense that notwithstanding the leaks that we've seen in the last number of weeks and months, the ability to fix this or stop this, depending on your perspective, is, from the perspective of many, is highly unlikely. And I have to say they may be right. On a week in which, in the United Kingdom and Britain, the Digital Economy Bill was passed with virtually no debate, as the government already moved towards an election, it is easy to be pessimistic. And yet if we are going to find some kind of optimism, I think it is in meetings like this. It is in the examples that we have seen around the world, here, where there are efforts trying to deal with the first 92A, provisions in terms of the internet blackout and the effort to call attention to this and really push back against what the government here in New Zealand was thinking about. Or in Canada, where a group that I started called Fair Copyright for Canada, which started with just a bunch of my Facebook friends, grew to more than 90,000 people in Facebook chapters in cities across the country and ultimately led the government first to delay introducing legislation and ultimately not going anywhere quickly with it, although we're likely to get a bill within the next month or two, and it's likely not to be all that great. But we've seen the ability for people to speak out, and we've seen it in other places as well. In France, La Cagature de Net, which was the source of the most recent leak, was started just by a couple of people who were concerned about this issue and used the technology, used the internet itself to raise awareness and put pressure on members of the European Parliament, members of the French National Assembly. In the UK, the Open Rights Group hasn't been as effective, at least not this week, but in the past, their efforts have paid off. And so we've seen real opportunities. And in the United States, there are lots of groups like EFF and EPIC and Public Knowledge, and perhaps most importantly, at least of late, on the issue of ACTA, Knowledge Ecology International, KEI, which has been writing and actively working on these issues. If we look at the text, we see that notwithstanding the best efforts and now 8 rounds of negotiation, there is still a lot of disagreement. Notwithstanding the efforts to keep all of this secret, there is a leak almost a week, it would seem, with respect to ACTA. And so notwithstanding efforts to say we're going to get this done within a matter of months and we're going to keep the public completely out of the process, we now have meetings where 100 people will show up on a Saturday with the actual text sitting on the table. That tells us that this issue isn't done yet. And so what can be done? I think that's the subject for the day. And I think if we take a look at some of the activities that we've seen in countries like this one and mine and in places around the world, there is still a glimmer of hope that we can take a look at these issues, identify the concerns, at a minimum try to fix this and make sure that if there is going to be an ACTA, it's not one that's going to raise the kinds of issues that I've just talked about for the last bit. Thanks very much for your attention.
Thank you, Michael. That was fantastic.